นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนมัสสามิgetting close to the end of this chapter called The Fourth Exit Point from the Cycle. And we had covered the first five of the seven Sapurisa Dhamma, the qualities of a well-rounded or good-hearted, good-natured person. So the next one on that list is Paris Anyuta. So Parisa is a group. So the Buddha Parisa means the community of the of Buddhist disciples or the students, followers of the Buddha. Paris Anyuta. Please join us, Ajahn. Parisanyuta, this means knowing the group of people that we are currently relating to, the company we are keeping, and the context within which we are meeting each other. Are we with our parents? Are we visiting a school? Are we in our own country or in a place where we don't know the language? Are we in the role of teaching a group of students? Are we one patient on a hospital ward? Are we putting our children to bed? Who are we with? Who are we with, and what is the relationship between us all? So Parisanyuta is knowing the locale, the people, the language, to communicate skillfully. Just as the Buddha described in the passage quoted back in chapter 1, quote, if one varies the terminology as one travels through different regions, continually bearing in mind how these various terms are applied to the same household object, then all divisive bias will be avoided. So that's from Sutta number 139 in the Majjhima Nikaya, which is a very helpful way of reflecting on use of language, use of terminology, and so on. So this is, again, as I was saying before, this is all to do with a mindfulness and full awareness and appreciation of the context that we're in, what's the situation. So the parisa is that, along with the right amount of things for matanyuta, the right timing for things. This similarly is parisanyuta. What's the group that we're with? Are we with people that we know, people we don't know? Are we in a following role, a leading role? Are we in a teaching role or a student role? Or are we there for practical purposes? Are we there for a holiday or entertainment? You know, what's the connection that we have with the people that we're with? So it's a way of, in a sense, stepping out of our own preoccupations or our own habits and that sense of, well, who am I with? What needs to be said here? What's the connection between us? And that is a way of expanding that sense of attunement to the time, the place, the situation. And a part of that can also be, I think we were talking the other day about not knowing. That's what I think we were talking about. So a part of parisanyuta is when you don't know how to relate to a group, like, well, what should I say here? Or who are these people? Or what's the right thing to do in this situation? So allowing oneself to not know, and also going back to mindfulness of awkward feeling, like, oh, I'm not quite sure how I should relate to this. That readiness to be with in an unknown situation, not quite sure what's the best way to relate or what's appropriate, that's to anyway, mindfully be aware of that, knowing that you don't know, and not being sure what's the best way. That's also that's not a weakness, it's, I would say it's part of skillfully attuning to the situation that we're in. But any questions, thoughts on parisanyuta? Knowing this groupness. And well, the last one is pugalanyuta. So a pugala is a person. And so that there's a Pali word for a person. So not just knowing the group that you're with, like you're in a schoolroom or you're in a hospital ward or you're supposed to be the doctor or you're supposed to be the patient. And fitting in with a particular group. So pugalanyuta is appreciating the characteristics of one other individual person. So pugalanyuta, this means knowing the character and role of individual people. It's something of a subset of the previous group. When we consider distinctive differences between others and take those into account, when we contemplate someone's temperament, abilities and shortcomings, when we recollect our past experiences of communicating with that person, all this is to have developed pugalanyuta. This skill also guides us to assess whether someone might be reliable as a friend or as a business partner, how they might fare in the monastic life, how they might handle, for example, a leadership role or a student role, how it would be best to relate to them. Lastly, it can be reliably guide us to communicate skillfully with another person, whether to praise them or criticize, whether to advise them or ask them questions. So again, that's a sense of tuning into, you know, who you're with, why are you together, what's the situation, what the characteristics of that particular person are. You know, if they are someone that that you know well or you don't know well, someone that you have a painful history with, or someone that you have been very close to, in a warm and friendly way. I'd say within the monastery, a job that needs to be done, you're thinking about, okay, well, this person, they just finished that role, you know, would they be good at this particular job? Is this a kind of a skill that they have? Would that be a good fit or not? So there's in monastic life, particularly living in community, there's a lot of, especially if you're in a responsible role, there's a lot of pugalanyuta, kind of, just sort of appreciating people's characteristics. Also not pigeonholing people, saying, oh, that, you know, this person, they should be good at this, or therefore they're matched to that particular role, or, you know, judging a person in a particular way and then fixing that judgment as a rigid standard, but also to have that, again, an appreciation of uncertainty with it. Well, this might be a good fit, or it might not be a good fit. Well, let's just try it and see what happens. Okay, put them in charge and see what they do with it. Or, you know, let them have responsibility for that and see whether it's a good result or not. And again, Lumpur Cha, Lumpur Sumato, in their leadership of communities, they're very, very good at letting people take responsibility for different things, whether it was cleaning things, building things, looking after, being an attendant, bowl washing or robe sewing, or giving guidance to lay people, or dealing with foreigners, and just letting people have a chance to try their skill. So it's also part of pugalanyuta is that. Again, along with not judging people or putting people into pigeonholes, it's also part of it is not trying to control everybody, or the feeling that, you know, you are you want people to be a certain way in order for you to feel comfortable. But I think, as we were saying yesterday, letting people be who they are and to function through those particular qualities of personality and character. And I was giving that example of the great arahants in the Gosinga forest. Letting people they have a bit of a free hand, and then watching how things work out. That someone might not be particularly good at a certain job, but they might really enjoy it. Okay, well, it hasn't worked out in the most efficient way, but, you know, I've never seen him look so happy. So okay, that's something to bear in mind. So maybe that isn't done quite so efficiently, but they really enjoy it, and other people appreciate them looking after it. So, okay, let's Let's go with that. And so that appreciation of both the individual and then the group situation, these Parisanyutta and Pugalanyutta, is a lot of the aspects of community life, whether you're a lay person or a monastic and living together. We draw upon those skills on a very regular basis to appreciate where people are at, also giving people a chance, giving each other the space to develop our own skills, our own interest, and to find ways that we can function effectively in the world and also contribute to community life. So that's the Pugalanyutta. That's the seventh of that list of seven. Questions, comments? There's a whole book of the Abhidhamma called the Pugala Panyati, which is the translation is something like the discrimination of human types. And it's a kind of personality profiles of the different kinds of characters. I've never studied Abhidhamma in to any extent at all, really, but you do come across references and things where they quote the Pugala Panyati in different human characters, and so if you are interested in that, how within the Pali tradition that different character types are distinguished, then you can look at the Pugala Panyati. The only one I can remember off the top of my head of that is that a description of a particular character was the kind of person who digs a hole and climbs into it and then complains that they can't get anywhere. So there's a quite earthy, literally kind of pun intended, quite earthy description. So you kind of, I thought, okay, that's... then, they dig the hole, they climb into it, and then blame the world for creating, keeping them trapped, and that kind of thing. Yes, Alex.
Just wondering how these characteristics relate, sort of the idea with like neurodivergent people, like because people with all sorts of these sort of neurodivergences may struggle in certain aspects. With awareness of people and stuff. So I was just wondering, because you seem like a good person to
talk about that. Yeah, there's a certain amount of match-up. I mean, there's sort of ways of describing different human traits and qualities. They sort of vary over time. Every few decades there's a different way of categorizing different types. But I think there's a certain amount of correspondence, because people... In 2,500 years, people haven't changed that much, and so I think it's one of the things is that does come across is that there is a divergence of different characteristics, different personality types, but there isn't a kind of a strict definition of one being better than another, one is worse than another, but so this is. This is a format that you have to work with, or you might need to work with, and looking at the strengths and weaknesses, or the obstacles that can come with those particular characteristics. But it is always the important thing is the attitude with which we work with those conditions, and that we can have in what might be seen as a really fortunate set of characteristics, but then be a really obnoxious person on account of that. or you can have characteristics that seem quite challenging or an obstacle, but then out of having a good heart and a skillful attitude, then those seemingly obstructive qualities can be recognized as basically insignificant, because they don't hinder you being a good person or practicing Dhamma and so on. So that that kind of different, slightly different way of looking at it, that could, whether someone's very intelligent or not very intelligent, is in a way a bit beside the point. It's like, well, you know, what do they do with that? How do they, do they use that situation to cultivate what is wholesome and let go of what is unwholesome, that kind of thing. But yeah, if you look up in the Abhidhamma books, Pugala Panyati, the discrimination of human types, I think it might have been one of the ones that Bhikkhu Nyanamoli translated. I'm not absolutely sure, but there is an English translation of that, one of the Abhidhamma, so that you can probably seek it out in the library. Other questions, thoughts? These seven kinds of knowledge are known as the Sapurisa Dhamma, the qualities of a well-rounded person. I find these qualities are very valuable in many situations, family get-togethers, on the London Underground, in the monastery, everywhere. All of these are the result of developing mindfulness and full awareness and wise reflection. If we nurture these seven Sapurisa Dhamma, they actively deprive ignorance, avijja, of its fuel. They support the development of the Noble Eightfold Path and thereby open up that fourth exit point from the destructive addictive cycle well before it has begun. There's an old Alcoholics Anonymous saying that if you sit in a barber's chair long enough, you'll eventually get your hair cut. There's many varieties of that. It's like if you spend long enough in a bar, you're going to wind up having a drink, or and so on. If you go to enough parties, you'll end up having some kind of relationship. So this area really relates to that. This means that if you go to visit pubs and bars often enough, sooner or later you'll end up having a drink. So don't go near the pub. If you don't want a haircut, get out of the barber's chair. If we don't want to put ourselves in the position of temptation, we will not slip. Sorry, if we don't put ourselves in the position of temptation, we will not slip up and tumble tail over tea kettle or head over heels and make that sudden turn, quote unquote, the fall. The catastrophe means a sudden turn or a fall. Is the literal etymology of catastrophe. Katastrophe from Greek. Trophine, the fall, or undergo the catastrophe of dependent origination, ending up in the crumpled heap of Soka Parideva Dukkha Dominas Upayasa, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. This fourth exit point is about good friends and skillful living, the not climbing into the barber's chair, quote unquote, so that there is no fuel to power the turning of the wheel of becoming. This is how it operates before link number one and provides a wholesome and beneficial basis for our life. Though once again, this isn't a fixed and sort of classical interpretation, but in reflecting on this, I felt it's a very, very significant point, and how you have these key teachings like in the Mangala Sutta, Asevana Chabalana, not to associate with the foolish, but to associate with the wise. This is the highest blessing. The dialogue between the Buddha and Venerable Ananda, when Ananda says that spiritual friendship is half of the holy life, and the Buddha says, no, it's not half the holy life, it's the whole of the holy life, Ananda. Again, why monasteries exist is a sort of mutual support situation where we come together to support the most helpful and liberating qualities within ourselves. And so it's in a way because of this principle of spending time around good people and that to encourage the development of the best in us. It's all about trying to deprive ignorance of its fuel, so that we set the conditions in place, make it as optimally supportive to spiritual practice. That's why the Buddha established monasteries and the monastic training, the five precepts, the eight precepts for the lay community. He set those structures up in order to help us to do the best we can in this this human life of ours And so that all of that, like regular taking the refuges and the precepts, living in monasteries, coming to visit monasteries, spending time in monasteries, taking ordination, temporary ordination or long-term ordination. You know, these are all ways to keep the avijja engine away from the petrol pump, keeping the fuel away from that the avijja engine, and so that we're setting the conditions as much as is possible. We set the conditions in place to support the development of the wholesome, and to obstruct the development of the unwholesome. Any questions, thoughts? That's the end of that chapter. Silence. Okay, so I'll continue. So the last chapter of the main part of the book is called Just This. This is chapter 8. We bring our attention to the experience of the present reality. We open our heart to this day. A day can feel like a really long time or a short time. Even 5 seconds can seem like a really long time. Our perceptions of time are subjective. Whether something feels like a long time or a short time is up to the attitude of this mind. Well, the next section is called Bhava, the drug of choice. The more the heart is entangled in the feeling of becoming, the less time there seems to be. So the word bhava, or becoming, is important to understand. The more the heart is entangled with becoming, the more our life is an experience of continual pressure. It might be an exciting pressure, but it's still a stressful feature nonetheless. It forms around an attitude of me trying to get somewhere else, a feeling that I am on my way to this other thing. It might be something that we're attracted to, something that we want, something that we're afraid of, something that we feel a duty to engage with, something that is irritating. Any of these can be an object of becoming. Attraction, aversion, fear, duty, all of these make the heart very crowded. Yet most of us are comprehensively addicted to the sense of being and identity that we get from all of that. The pleasant, the painful, the comic, and the tragic, doesn't matter as long as it brings a sense of defined being, me being something. Investigate this feeling. As we feel ourselves being pulled or pushed towards the next thing, we ask ourselves, where am I going? Who's trying to get there? We might discover that even while we are walking in a park, there's the feeling of, I'm getting somewhere, regardless of the fact that it's just around a lake, in order to walk back again to where we began. Notice that sensation of me getting somewhere. So this is talking about bhava, and one of the points I like to highlight is that just after the Buddha's enlightenment, it was reflecting on the ubiquitous nature of bhava, that after the Buddha's enlightenment, there's this it's just internal reflection is recorded in the Vinaya text that's describing that he realizes, you know, all the beings of the world are they are addicted to becoming. They love becoming. They relish becoming, but what they relish, what they love, brings pain. Yeah, and so this holy life is lived for the ending of suffering, and his on account of appreciating that sense of what was apparently like a universal addiction to becoming, loving existence, loving that sense of being, relishing that, you know, being attached to that, then his feeling is there's no point trying to teach. There's no point trying to. It's like in a world full of addicts. You're the only person who's not on the drug. You know, where do you start? You know, a billion, well, there wouldn't have been a billion people alive in the world, probably in the Buddha's time, but many, you know, quite a few millions or hundreds of millions. You know, so that feeling of where would you start? This is hopeless. This is everywhere. And it, so it was that recognition of being caught in that that love of defined existence. And again, it's not necessarily around something positive or delightful. It can be around wanting revenge, or wanting to have a position in the group, or wanting to or not being able to let go of a particular wrong that's been done to us. You know, it doesn't have to be pleasant to be giving us a sense of defined being, like an unrequited something that's been some wrong that's been done to us that we want to revenge, or someone who's broken our heart, or someone who's treated us badly, is equally good as something that is that you're proud of, or is a great achievement, or that's something that you want to be seen as. So that a defined sense of being, it can be any one of a vast variety of objects. So the word bhava, sometimes it's translated as being, sometimes as becoming, sometimes as existence. There's different translators have rendered it in different ways, but existence is a helpful word, because it literally means to stand out from, that which stands out. Exi meaning out, ex meaning out, exit, the fire exit. Ex means out, and then stance or stence is to stand. It comes from the Latin for to stand. So that's that which is standing out. So that sense of being apparent or visible, defined. That's even though we might think existence or being is of an intrinsic good, or that being or existence is synonymous with life and reality and goodness, in terms of Buddhist philosophy, that the Buddha took a slightly different angle, because he could see that whereas in Vedanta, being, consciousness, bliss, Satchit Ananda was sort of taken as the characteristics of ultimate reality, then the Buddha was saying, well, actually, if you look closely, the sense of being or existence, defined identity, that there's a limitation there. There's dukkha that's wrapped up in that. And so, and then that insight that he had just after the enlightenment, that all the beings of the world, they only know becoming, they relish becoming, they're addicted to becoming, but what they're addicted to, what they relish brings fear, and what they fear is pain. So that he could see that attachment to defined being, attachment to being something, that was right there was a cause of fear, and a fear of pain. And because the more there is an I, the more there is an other, and that other causes a threat to the I. And there's one of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, that I was looking at the other day. the rough synopsis of the beginning of it is a bit more flowery and complicated, but the brief version of the opening of that Upanishad is, it says, originally in the mind of the originally there was just the mind of the Absolute in the infinite void. And then in the mind of the Absolute, there arose the thought, I am. With the thought, I am, there arose fear. And following that fear, there arose desire. So the I am creates an other, and then a fear of feeling a threat from the other, and then a desire to get hold of something that's going to keep that threat away. So it's in that particular scripture a way of describing the sort of how the universe comes into being, but also I feel it's a really good description of what happens in our minds when we meditate. As soon as there's an I am, then as soon as there's an I, then there's an other, and then the mind starts to seek for something for the I to protect itself or distract itself, something to get away from that vulnerable, alienated, insecure I feeling. So that, and I would say it's not an uncommon experience where in those moments where there's a letting go, and there is the mind grasping at something, like in meditation, you can see your mind's been chasing after a noise that we hear, or a feeling in the body, or an idea, or a mood in the mind, and it's recognized and it's let go of. There can be a moment of relief, because that thing has been let go of, and there's a certain sense of the kind of contrast to grasping, and there's a pleasant sense of letting go, the sigh of relief. But then, and again, I don't know if many of you have noticed this, but a few seconds after that letting go, that you can find the mind hunting for another thing to be, like, there must be something I'm supposed to be doing. Oh yeah, back to the breath, you know, go on to meditation, or there's this other problem I've got, I've still got to work that out. And there's this mysterious chemistry whereby, even though you've just thought of another problem you've got to solve, another thing you've got to do, there's a relief that goes, phew, you know, I'm back to being me again, who's got to do something. But that this fear of undefined being, of like, what am I? That is often what we spend a lot of time and energy and effort and money trying to get away from, a fear of undefined being, because psychologically, that's a death experience. What if I'm not that? If I don't, there isn't a me pushing against something or chasing after something, what am I? And that can be deeply disquieting. And so, even remembering that you got 54 emails that you got to reply to, phew, you know, that's a thing for me to be. I mean, and then that sense of even though it's a lot of work that is in prospect, there's a relief that I am this person who's got to answer all these emails, or I've got to do this or be that, or I've got this insoluble problem, that, you know, this difficulty that's never going to go away, or this issue that's, you know, that is it's up to me to figure out. And so that was one of the kind of reasons the Buddha, after his enlightenment, thought, you know, this is everywhere. This kind of love of defined being, it's everywhere. But then the Brahma Sahampati came along, and as we do the invitation for a Dhamma talk, it recounts that very incident where Brahma Sahampati picked up this thought in the Buddha's mind that the newly enlightened Buddha is inclined towards solitude and not teaching. So, the world will be lost. The world will be utterly lost. And so Sahampati beams down from the Brahma world and appears in front of the Buddha and says, please, for the sake of those who have a... There are some beings with lots of dust in their eyes and some beings with just a little dust in their eyes. And for the sake of those with just a little dust, please share the understanding that you have. And yes, a story many of us are familiar with, but I feel as we're here because the Buddha then cast his vision around the world and realized, yeah, Sahampati is, this Brahma deity is correct. There are beings who are very entangled and caught up, got a lot of dust in their eyes, but there are beings with just a little bit of dust in their eyes, and so for the sake of the almost dust-free, then the Buddha agreed to teach. And so we have this whole Buddha Parisa and the whole community and the Dhamma teaching, Dhamma Vinaya, that's come down over 2,500 years today on account of that. So, but I think it's significant that his first thought was, there's no point trying. So it tells us this is a very dense quality of conditioning. This is a very strongly conditioned habit. And in my own experience of Dhamma practice, this is something it's so helpful to get to know, because to the habits of self-view and the ego, undefined being, it feels like death, a kind of ego death. Like, if I'm not that, what am I? But to the heart itself, if there's a kind of passing through that curtain, if there isn't a kind of intimidation or just seeking distraction or switching off at that point, if there is that, let's say, passing through that habitual reaction, then to the citta itself, to the heart itself, that quality of undefined being has the taste of freedom. There's a delight in that. There's a quality of wonderment and delight. There's no sense of loss. To the ego, it's a sense of loss. It's like a deposed tyrant being booted out of their role of leadership. But to the heart itself, it's like, oh, thank goodness. glad that's over, or I don't have to be limited or bound by that. So I often quote these bumper stickers you'd see in San Francisco Bay Area would have very philosophical bumper stickers, and one of them was something along the lines of, "Why be a whole person when you can be a brilliant wounded fragment?" that we can attach to our kind of brokenness or our problems or our dukkha, and that can be far more appealing. It's far more defined edges than say a feeling of wholeness or a sense of not defining ourselves around ego-centered perceptions, but it can be far more attractive to identify with our pain and our problems, and it's a strange thing, but that can be a source of great satisfaction. I'm not putting that down, but it is mysterious how you can kind of be proud of the terrible things that you've had to endure. It's like a kind of badge of honor of the painful things, and that but unconsciously seeing that even though maybe you're doing your best to work with that, there's something that's saying, this is me, this defines me, this is what I am this. And in the very effort to try and work with something, you've actually dramatized it and reified it. You made it, rather than seeing through it and seeing its empty nature, that there's a way that relishing of defined being, I am this is my problem, this is my big issue, then that rather than working with it, you've made it into something that is real and solid, and this is me, this is what I am, etang mama eso hamasmi eso me ata, this is me, this is what I am, this is myself. Any thoughts, reflections on all of that? Okay. We can even observe the quality of becoming while sitting still, in our own home as well as on a train or a plane, in the car as well as in a meditation hall. Whether it's trying to get to a physical destination like Chiang Mai or London or Paris, or to get concentrated, the process and the energy is the same. We can watch the thoughts creating possibilities of future activities, places, experiences. We can observe this quality of becoming through the mind attaching to any changing condition. If we bring attention to this, we find that there is a leaning into the imagined next moment. Quid nunc, what now, in Latin, is the ancient Latin way of expressing this feeling. What now? So that looking away from this anticipate or be drawn into expectation, anticipation of the next thing. In the suttas it says, Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. Bhava Nirodho Nibbanang. That's again in the Book of the Tens, in the numerical discourses. Sutta number 7, if you want to follow that up. This is a very short but powerful statement. If we interpret that as meaning that Nibbana is only realized when all conditions of the world and the mind have stopped, evaporated, life is going to be very difficult. If it meant, quote, the stopping of all action, unquote, we'd have to stop breathing, walking, talking. So that's obviously not a realistic interpretation. By saying Nibbana is the cessation of becoming, it doesn't mean that we freeze in our tracks, or that we stop the breath from entering and leaving the body, or even that we stop the flow of thought in order to realize Nibbana. Rather, it's a change of attitude towards those transient conditions. the arising and passing of experience. It's the quality of non-entanglement with the experience of changing conditions, seeing their ownerless and insubstantial nature. It's the restfulness that comes from not grasping, not clinging, not identifying with what is being experienced. So the cessation is not just a thing, the stopping of a thing that has begun, but it's also the ending of the thingness, the mind, in a way, recognizing the transparency or the empty, insubstantial nature of conditions. So there's a form, there's an appearance, there's a shape that things have, like my hand or this room or this book or you know, other people. So there's a shape, but that when we talk about cessation, it's recognizing, well, that's a shape, that's a form, but it's not giving it any kind of absolute substance. So when the Buddha gives one of the most well-known teachings of his on emptiness, he talks about the empty nature of the five khandhas. And so the rupa khanda, the material form, the body, he compares to a lump of foam on a river. So they're standing by the river Ganges, I think, at Ayodhya in India. And so there was a lump of foam floating along the river. And the Buddha said, you see that lump of foam on the river, the rupa, material form is just like that lump of foam. Then he explains Vedana, a sensation or feeling. So it's like when rain falls onto a pond, then the raindrops splash, and there's a bubble forms as the raindrops hit the surface. The Vedana is just like a water bubble. Again, there's a shape, but there's no substance. There's nothing solid there. And then sanya, perception, he says it's like a mirage in the desert. If you're out in the desert and you can see a shape in the air, you might see palm trees or buildings, but that's an appearance. It's just a formation of light, but there isn't really a building there or not in that spot. There is not really those palm trees or buildings in that particular place. It's a mirage is empty. There's a shape but no substance. And then sankhara, mental formations, thoughts, feelings, emotions, imagination, and so on. They said that's like a banana plant. Like it's just a sheaf of leaves, like an onion or a leek. There's no heartwood, there's no core, so that you peel away the leaves and there's no central trunk. So he said sankharas are like a banana plant, like a plantain. And then the last one, vijnana, he said, is like a conjuring trick, like a magician performing a conjuring trick. It looks like there's some magic being done, but it's just it's just a trick. It's just an appearance, a seeming. So with nibbana is the cessation of becoming. It's the mind not being caught into that apparent substantiality or that the flow of a particular event and attaching to, oh, when this is over then, or this is something that is real and solid, so that peacefulness, nibbana, is the peaceful quality of the mind knowing that essentially the Dhamma is always here, that things are not going to be more real when that changes, or that this has come to an end, or that this particular thing, either hoping that it'll stay because it's pleasant or hoping that it'll go because it's unpleasant, but rather that the thingness or the solidity, the substantiality of any perception, any condition of the natural world, physical or mental, is seeing the empty, insubstantial, transparent nature. So in this respect, cessation or emptiness, sunyata, is not related to absence so much as transparency, if that makes sense.
Question, Ajahn.
Sure.
It's about the difference between bhava nirodha and vibhava.
Vibhava,
yeah. Because quite often, I think in one of the sutras it says something like, the noble disciple, he doesn't lets go of becoming, but he doesn't delight in non-becoming. And at the same time,
the cessation of becoming is nibbana.
Mm-hmm.
So just that. What was it? What's the difference between
Well, vibhava tanha, I mean, it's a kind of craving, so it's like longing for things, a particular thing to end. So it's the desire for something to not be, to not feel, to not be, for something to get rid of something. So that it's the, in that, the mind is you know, giving a sense of solidity, like wanting these thoughts to stop. Or wanting to get away from an uncomfortable situation. That's the vibhava tanha. So it's saying these thoughts are real and solid, and when they, if only they'd stop, if only I could switch them off, then I would be happy. So it's like, in a way, the mind is reifying, it's giving the thoughts or the situation a solidity, and then a hope that when I want this to switch off, I want to get rid of this, because this is an intrusion, or this is a burden, or this is stressful. And if this wasn't here, then I would be happy. So it's making those thoughts or those feelings or perceptions, or emotions, into a substantial actual presence. So bhava nirodha, the cessation of becoming, is where the mind has let go of that. It's not identified with that condition. It's like it's seeing the empty nature of those thoughts rather than wanting happiness by their absence, or wanting them to go away. It's seeing that, well, these are just thoughts. I mean, how could these possibly be anything substantial or real? There's no thing there. So that bhava nirodha, that the mind isn't investing that particular condition with there's no identification, it's not giving any substantiality, any reality. It's just, oh, it's just a thought, it's just a sound, it's just an emotion, it's just a mood, whether it's here or not. That, how could that really obstruct the Dhamma? How could that really be burdensome? So it's a very different quality. It's not a kind of bhava nirodha. It's not a kind of craving. It's a change of attitude in relationship to seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. Does that make sense? Okay. The next section is called Watching a World Arise. As we look about us in life, we can discover, oh, the woman in the next seat, who I thought was a primary school teacher, is actually a famous film director. Or that fellow who I met in the park, who I was sure was a scientist, turns out he's a sculptor. We can watch how our version of the world comes into being. So this is often something that people experience at the end of a retreat, particularly if they've been doing a 10-day retreat together with quite a few people that they don't know. During the retreat, oftentimes people are kind of assigning roles to other folks, and they kind of assume that they kind of guess their name or their nationality or their livelihood. And so this is an abbreviated version of that kind of a discovery that people make. Oh my goodness, you know, this person that I completely misread who they were. I thought, she's definitely Swiss. I mean, she really looks Swiss. And you find out she's got a strong Glaswegian accent, you know, she's from Glasgow. Oh. So the way that we create each other and describe roles just on passing perceptions. That we can watch how our version of the world comes into being. It's not good, it's not bad, it's just this. Every day there's a great opportunity to see a world being born, seeing how we judge our own life, our personality, and judge the lives of others. We can watch those patterns, those perceptions, springing up and taking shape and dissolving. The senses, contact, and feelings arise. If we're able to recognize that the world is actually, quote, my version of the world, then we're able to be much more sensitive and spacious in the way we relate to others. In one very significant teaching, the Buddha said, that whereby one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world, that is called the world in this Dhamma and discipline. And what is the means whereby one is a perceiver of the world and a conceiver of the world? It is the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind. So, and those two terms, a perceiver of the world is loka sanyi. Sanya is perception, loka is the world. And a conceiver of the world is lokamani. Mana is conceit, conceiving. Lokamani, a conceiver of the world. So that's a teaching I quote very often because it's one of the habits of attachment and becoming and so on is that we assume that the world that we experience is the world everyone else is experiencing. And so and we tend to make that as an unconscious judgment. And then when people act in their own ways, we get confused or irritated, or and say, "How can he do that? Or, what did she do? Why did she do that? Yeah, that's crazy. That's ridiculous." It's only crazy or ridiculous most often because it doesn't fit in with our particular habits or perceptions. Because we're assuming that everybody else is seeing the same world that we do. But if we recognize that what we each experience is not the world, it's a world. It's the our mind's version of the world in this moment, according to the conditioning of this mind, these perceptual systems, the language that we speak, our personal history, and so on and so forth. So if we remember that what is experienced here is just this mind's version of the world, then it's much closer to the surface. Well, of course, other people see a different world. And a very simple way of demonstrating this is I'm sitting here and I say, which way is my finger pointing? And I would say, it's pointing to the left. Where sitting from where you are, you would say either it's pointing away from me, or it's pointing towards me, or it's pointing to the right. From where I am, it's clearly pointing to the left. But because geographically we're sitting in different places, then we see a different picture. So when we appreciate that we are experiencing one version of the world, then and that's seen with wisdom, then the recognition, well, of course, other people are going to see things differently. They're going to have different priorities, different concerns, different interests. Naturally, how could it not be that way? And so on account of that, then we find we've got much more space for each other. We can accommodate each other. If we're assuming everyone should think like me, and if they don't think like me, then they're deluded or wrong, then we're creating a lot of dukkha for ourselves and probably the people around us. There was a famous, when Ajahn Jayasaro was the abbot at Wat Pa Nanachat for about 5 years, one of the monks there was a fairly skilled at Photoshop, and they had a group photograph of the monastic community, and he put Ajahn Jayasaro's head onto the bodies of all the other monks and novices in the photograph and captioned it, "The Perfect Monastery." Everyone thinks like me, so it must be perfect. So it was a kind of comment on sort of a dharmic commentary on how we can be. We can see how those perceptions arise and how the mind can give them value. How do we feel about other people? The perception of scientist has one feeling, sculptor has another feeling. We create each other. We produce different judgments and perceptions out of habit, out of our conditioning, out of our social situation. We tend to believe our perceptions as absolutely true, but we can be aware that this is a creation or a naming that the mind has put upon perceptions of the present. As Ajahn Chah put it, we determine things into existence. This awareness gives a great freedom to our own heart, and it gives great freedom to others as well. The kindest thing that you can do for other people is not to create them. Just as the kindest thing that we can do for ourselves is not to create this person that we think that we are either. This might sound a bit strange, but on reflection, perhaps it makes some sense. It's a great relief not to be created into a particular role. There's a friend of the Sangha in California who's quadriplegic in a wheelchair, and he once told me that one of the great happinesses in his life was when people would talk to him and not, quote, not talk to the chair, unquote. So as we receive the world into our hearts and we watch it come into being each moment, a useful exercise in developing compassion, kindness, and harmonious relationships is not to create people. He also, his name is Daniel Barnes, and he also said that people like himself who have to go about in a wheelchair, he said that they're one of the terms they use for the more mobile population is the is TABs, temporarily able-bodied. So we are TABs, temporarily able-bodied. It was a very skillful way of relating to your own habitual assumptions about life. So does that make sense about not creating yourself, not creating others? It's about, you know, we make a judgment, we assess ourselves or someone else in a particular way, and then we carry that around. And so if we are creating each other, then when we meet or we have to engage or work together or talk together, then the more that the mind is, you know, sort of locked onto its own assumptions and preconceptions, then you don't actually see the other person. You're just talking to your projection about them. And they're probably doing the same to you. So you don't have a dialogue. You actually have two monologues sort of going past each other. That they're talking to their projection of you and you're talking to your projection of them. So there isn't really a communication, a communion, but rather it's the air is being filled with words, but there isn't really a meeting, a connection. And so that when we can recognize that habit and leave it aside, not make assumptions about each other, but really be mindful and attuned to each present experience, then, yeah, of course, our bodies don't suddenly transform or our faces drop off and such like, but the basic physical perceptions are there, but we're not coming from a place of assumption or, you know, presumption about each other. And we are much more able to attune and adapt all those saparisa qualities, the way we're able to attune to the time, the place, the situation, who we're with, and we're not always feeling like we've got to, we don't know what we're doing, or I'm in charge, I know what's going on here. But you don't make those presumptions, but there's rather an openness, and there's a sensitivity that's based on a genuine quality of mindfulness and wisdom, mindfulness and full awareness. Also, speaking of the world coming into being, one of the examples I often give about that was, I'd noticed when I would begin, going to my secondary school was very traumatic. I didn't really notice it there because it was going from a junior school where you're one of the senior pupils to being in the lower classes of a boys' boarding school. I was a day pupil, but it was a boarding school, and where you're very junior, there's a very, very distinct pecking order, and I was 10 when I started at secondary school, just had my 10th birthday, and so that I was kind of in a state of shock when that particular change from one environment to another came about. But I did notice it when I went to university, went to college in London, and that sense of, I don't know anybody here, I don't know the buildings, I don't know who the teachers are, I don't know anything. And I saw how over the period of about 6 weeks or a couple of months that you get to know your way around the campus, you get to know who the people are, you get to, and then watching this sense of, oh, in 2 months ago, none of this was known to me. And now I've got this whole kind of map. And there's these different people are categorized. And you know, this one's interesting, this one's not interesting. I'm involved with that one, I'm not involved with that one. And that was really striking to me. Like, look at that. I didn't have any sense of the value system or where how things were arranged, and now it's this world that I know about. You know, it's familiar. And so when I arrived at Wat Panacha, so I was 18 when I started at college, and then I just had graduated in summer of 77, and then came into Wat Panacha in January of 78. So it wasn't that long after. So I thought, okay, this is a similar situation. I don't know anybody. I don't know anything about Buddhism. I've never read a Buddhist book. I don't know anything about monasteries or rules. And so this little kind of flag went up. I thought, okay, now this is a really good opportunity to once again watch a world come into being. Because you know, right now, you don't know anything. It's basically a completely blank slate. I literally had never read a Buddhist book. Before I walked in the monastery gate and got involved with this. So it's like, you don't know anything. And so then I'm watching that value system take shape over the next sort of 6 weeks, couple of months, 3 months. And so you know, after a few months, it's like, well, this Ajahn is really good, that Ajahn is not so good. And you know, we're Mahanikaya, they're Dhammayutta. And we are the forest tradition, they're the city monks. And this whole kind of... but I made a clear... So a clear, conscious resolution, like, okay, this is going to be another world that comes into being. Watch how that takes shape and how solid and real this all seems. But don't forget that 3 months ago you didn't know anything. This is all just you know, like marks on a whiteboard or a blackboard. You know, so that this is all an acquired value system, and that this is something that it's a world that's coming into being. It's no more real or substantial than the world of your college life and your physiology and psychology lecturers and such like. And so I didn't realize it at the time, but that was really helpful over the years to keep a perspective on both being you know, sincerely involved and committed to this life, but also remembering, you know, a year ago you didn't know about any of these ajahns, you never heard of Ajahn Chah. Never heard of Theravada or Mahayana. I thought the Buddha was Chinese for the first few months I was there. I just hadn't figured out that the Buddha was from India. I was cleaning the shrine the day before the observance day. I thought, it's funny, all these Buddha images, they look Indian. And they said, well, that's because the Buddha was from Nepal. And, so he was, that's why they look Indian. And I said, well, no, he's from China. Everyone knows the Buddha was from China. So I was ready to argue the point and be an expert, even though I was totally wrong. But so it was over the years. It was really really helpful because that sense of this is all an assumed reality. It's determined into existence, and the value system of Theravada and Mahayana, or this Ajahn versus that Ajahn. These are what you do. These are what you don't do. This is a good monk, this is a bad monk. All of that, just saying, you know, 6 months ago, none of this had any meaning. This world didn't exist. Now it exists. So, in a very helpful way, it kept all of that in context. It was a way of keeping a perspective on that, so that you're living with it, using these conditions, the traditions and forms and structures of this life, in a sincere way, but you're also remembering this is all just invented. And then so a lot of Ajahn Chah's teachings, where he would speak about that kind of thing, it made perfect sense to me. Like, you know, Theravada Buddhism is determined into existence. You know, he would sit in give a Dhamma talk and he'd say, there aren't really any people here. There's no women, there's no men, there's no nuns, there's no monks, there's no monastics, there's no lay people here. These are just formations. And so I could really resonate with that. It's all determined into existence, and that having that conscious recollection of, oh, that this value system has come into being, and then and say, you know, a year ago none of these words would have made sense, and now it's these got this distinct flavor, these distinct qualities, but it kept it in focus, kept the quality of the fundamentally empty nature of things in perspective. So I'll just read to the end of this section here. So as we receive the world into our hearts, we watch it come into being each moment. A useful exercise in developing compassion, kindness, and harmonious relationships is not to create people. This doesn't mean that when your grandchildren come running through the door saying they're happy to see you, you tell them that they don't exist. If a child is 5 years old and granny tells her that she's not real, that child will probably think that Buddhism is no good for granny. The practice being spoken of here, people do ask those kind of questions, like, Ajahn, I have this great insight into anatta, so how do I go back to my family? You know, how do I talk to them? You know, if I know there's nobody here, there's nobody there, what do I do? And so, you know, that's not uncommon that people ask those kind of questions. They have a profound insight. And I say, well, just play along with it. You know, just be yourself. And if your five-year-old grandchild says, hello, granny, don't say, actually, fundamentally, you're not there, and neither am I. It's not gonna fly. But to think granny has gone stupid. So the practice being spoken of here is not the picking up of some philosophical idea and then brandishing it as a concept to identify with, an achievement or self-protection. Rather, it is expanding the view. It's relaxing expectations and projections and opening the heart to the fullness of the present reality. If we make the effort not to create each other, we can see what the effect of that is. Be attentive, attuned to the present reality. We then let our words and actions and feelings be guided by that attunement. I encourage us all to look into our hearts to see how this feels, the freedom of non-creation, the freedom of not judging others as being this or that, or ourselves, you know, wanting to be seen in particular ways, the freedom of not having to be someone special. I'd like to tell a story about one particular friend of the Sangha who used to visit Chithurst Monastery back in the early 80s. In those days, the old Victorian house at Chithurst was a building site. The floors had only scraps of leftover carpet. People used to donate sort of offcuts of carpet, so there was a bit of a mishmash of carpet scraps to cover the floorboards, where the floors hadn't rotted away through dry rot, so it was pretty rough living. The floors had only scraps of leftover carpet to cover them. Most of the tea mugs didn't have handles or had chips in the sides. It was a pretty rough environment. This friend of the Sangha was a local woman who used to come and visit regularly. She'd been married to the British ambassador to Japan. When she came to visit, she would sit down quite delicately on the scraps of carpet, sip her tea daintily from the chipped mug, and was obviously a very refined lady. One day she said, "The reason I love to come to Chithurst is because here I can be a potato." And that she did actually go to Cheltenham Ladies' College, so she did have an accent just like that. So. Cut glass Cheltenham Ladies College accent. And that's exactly what she said. The reason I love to come to Chithurst is because here I can be a potato. And she really meant it. She didn't have to be the ambassador's wife or a gracious lady. She could just enjoy the company of good friends and sip her tea and not care that the cup was chipped or the place was covered in paint or plaster dust. What a delight not to have to be this thing, this role, this identity. How joyful to be able to let that go, unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed. So I'll leave it there for today.
Andamayam dhamma vada kataya sadhu karam dadamase sadhu sadhu.